This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. When it comes to education, American high schoolers don't test as well as those in some other developed countries. Teenagers in Japan, France, and Singapore, to name a few, test much better when it comes to math and science. So how do they do it? Is it better teaching, smaller classes, more money for education? Maybe it's the tests. Well, those are some of the questions that we will examine this hour as we compare American high schoolers to their counterparts in other countries. A bit later in the show, we'll hear two views on expanding No Child Left Behind into America's high schools. But first, how do they do it there? Now, if you have been a student or a teacher in another country, we would love to hear from you. Give us a call and help us make this comparison. What's different between the education system here and ones you may have encountered abroad? Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email address totn@npr.org. Our first guest is Grover Russ Whitehurst. He's with the Institute of Education Science. Russ, welcome.
I'm pleased to be here.
So how do American high schoolers compare to their peers abroad?
We don't do very well. We do quite well at fourth grade, a little bit above average at eighth grade, and by the time we're at 12th grade or in high school, our students are the caboose on the train.
How do we make this comparison? I'm always curious when I see these test results. You know, we rank 27th or something. What are the tests really comparing?
Well, there are a number of international tests. I was just referring to the TIMSS, which is the International Math and Science Study. And what happens is that an international consortium agrees to conduct the test. Experts decide what items are appropriate, and then random samples of students are taken from each country. They are given the assessment, the results are computed, and made available to the public.
So in essence, if I had 10 kids there, each from a different country, we asked them 100 questions, the Americans might answer fewer of those questions correctly than their foreign counterparts.
Yes.
Which doesn't necessarily get at whether or not they're better prepared to, you know, face the challenges of the next generation.
Well, it certainly suggests that they don't have the preparation that they need. One of our recent international assessments, the PISA examination, the Program for International Student Assessment, looked at mathematical literacy, defining that as the ability to solve real-world problems. And on that particular international assessment, 26 nations scored above us, only 12 below. We were way below average. These are the sorts of skills you'd need to compute how much lumber you would need to build a house, or how much gasoline you need to buy to get to your destination. So we did particularly poorly at real world problems.
So there is a correlation.
Yes.
So now, what are some of the differences between the United States and some other countries when it comes to let's say K through 12?
Well, we differ from our international competitors in a number of respects. Some of these may be important to our performance, others may not be. It's difficult to tell because these things come as packages. We find, for example, that our teachers are less well trained than is the case for teachers that students are encountering in many other countries. For example, on the TIMSS at 8th grade, 71% of students internationally were taught by teachers who had a degree in mathematics. That was the case for only 41% of the students in the United States.
I'm just going to stop you for a moment and remind our listeners that the TIMSS is this international test that
international
we're talking about.
International test of math and science performance. So our students are getting less qualified teachers who haven't majored in the subject that they're teaching nearly as frequently as the case overseas.
And does that mean that the programs, the education programs, are more stringent? Are they better aimed at meeting these needs, or at the needs of students, or do these teachers simply have more education?
Well, I think it's the case that the training of teachers overseas typically requires more, sets higher standards, attracts generally better qualified pool of applicants, and gives them the skills that are more directly related to what they'll be doing in the classroom.
Do they get paid better?
Pay is not a substantial difference across countries. The United States tends to invest quite well in K through 12 education. Last time I looked, we were behind only Switzerland in that regard.
So if it isn't pay, what is there an impediment, or is it just that why haven't we made the adjustment?
I think one of the reasons is that we haven't had good definitions of what it means to be a highly qualified teacher. That has been addressed in part by No Child Left Behind, but there's still big gaps in terms of the training of teachers, what's required to be certified. This varies from state to state. And often the bars to entry in terms of knowledge of content are really set quite low.
So teachers, the standards are different because we really haven't come up with a definition. Maybe it gets back to the sort of the momentum of my first question. Are we sure what it takes to teach a student, to make a good student, and to have that student come out qualified to make good judgments?
Well, one thing we do know is that highly qualified teachers make a big difference in student performance. That knowledge is there. It's well demonstrated. We haven't yet translated that well enough into practice in this country.
One of the things I've heard, too, we talk about international tests, is that often in other countries, the only kids who get tested are the kids who are doing well. I mean, is that part of the problem here, or is that true?
No, that's not part of the problem here. These the assessments I'm referring to, such as TIMSS, are conducted with nationally representative samples. So countries are not allowed to exclude students from these international assessments. I think they are fair yardsticks of how we're doing.
We're talking about education in America, comparing it to education abroad, where Americans tend to fare, at least according to the test results, not very well. And my guest this hour is Russ Whitehurst, who's director for the Institute of Education Science at the Institute of Education Science. And we're taking your phone calls this hour as well. And let me ask you this, Russ, if the curricula, how they vary from place to place and how they compare.
I think that curricula is an important part of the puzzle here. One expert has characterized mathematics and science curricula in this country as a mile wide and an inch deep. Hmm. That is, we tend to cover a lot of topics in a particular grade. Those topics reappear year after year. There's a lack of coherence that you would find immediately if you looked at a series of instructional books for learning the piano, for example, where you could see the logical sequence and you could see how book 30 related to book 28 and so forth down the line. Hard to identify that kind of coherence in our curriculum, and so we suffer in that regard compared to students overseas.
Any reason for that?
We don't have a national education system. In our constitutional system, education is left to the states, and in many cases is left to local districts and to local schools. So there's a great deal of variability there. That's a strength because you can get innovation, but it also makes it difficult to come up with both teacher training and curriculum that maps on what all students are expected to know, since what students are expected to know does differ from place to place.
So you raise the issue of standards and then right on its heels, accountability.
Yes.
The question is, in those countries, if they have a national standard, how do they hold the school system accountable? Do they look at standardized test results as the accountability measure?
Often in the countries we are comparing ourselves with, there is a high-stakes assessment system for students. This determines entry into university or whether students move into vocational education or to a post-secondary track. And so these national examinations are very serious, and families and students take the preparation for them quite seriously. In this country, we do not have that at the high school level, and where states have stepped in with some sort of competency exam at the state level, these exams tend to be minimal competence exams rather than curriculum-based assessments with high standards. So I think that standards, assessment, and accountability are linked together, and again, we compare unfavorably with many of the nations that perform higher in terms of standards, assessment, and accountability.
We're taking your phone calls this hour, 800-989-8255, to talk about education in America. Marita is on the line from Fountain Hills, Arizona. Hello, Marita.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I graduated in Albania. It's in South or East Europe. For most of the listeners, they don't know. But, you know, and it was a very poor country and communist and all that. We all know. The thing is that what I noticed comparing to the students here for a while I taught at Glendale Community College is that we take the school really, really, really seriously. And over here, the students know that one way or the other, they will be able to go at least to a community college. They don't have to have a certain standards passing the test there. It's really, really easy. And what happens is that why they don't have a drive. They don't. It's not important to them. It's more important, you know, to follow the style of everybody else. And what also I noticed is that I have. We also have a restaurant here in town, and I have college students that work part time. And then sometimes they ask me questions. Oh, what is the 2/3? Is it bigger 2/3 or the 1/3? And I'm like, oh my God, she's just in third year of college and she doesn't know the difference. You know, how do you explain to that? And I'm thinking, you know, where is the future of my children? So what I do, I try to work extra hours with them, especially math, because I know that's important. And just those, that little extra effort that I put with them, my kids are the best in school. And I'm wondering, I don't think it's the teacher's fault. It's just that, see, when I complain to my daughter's teacher that she's not getting enough homework, she said, well, all my parents are pressing me not to give them too much. They are complaining that their kid's having too much homework. And I'm like, well, my daughter is like going to high school pretty soon, and her homework can be done in 15 minutes.
Well, I want to get her. I want to get a response to this. Follow Menderit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Marita, so education standards in Albania, a little higher than the United States, and that maybe parents aren't pressing as hard. Could that be part of the problem, Russ, that we, none of us, take it seriously enough?
I think the standards are frequently higher in other countries. She's put her finger on something that's quite important. The United States is wonderful in that you always get a second chance, and that's desirable. But it's also easy for students to kind of breeze through the system and not take math and science seriously. We need higher standards. We need more AP courses. We need for students to understand that in the 21st century, their ability to do math and science is going to be important for their job success.
Well, we'll find out what else we need, too, this hour on Talk of the Nation as we continue our conversation about education. Still with us, Russ Whitehurst. He's with the Institute of Education Science. Want to hear from you at 800-989-TALK. Email address totn@npr.org. Stay with us. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about education in America today and how American students compare with students in countries overseas. We hear all the time that Americans, at least according to the test scores, don't do quite as well. We're trying to find out why. With us are Russ Whitehurst. He's the director for the Institute of Education Science at the Institute of Education Science. And joining us now is Steve Linewand. Linewand.
Yes.
I did have that right. Thank you very much, Steve. And he's also with the American Institute for Research. And let me ask you, Steve, you have done research looking at the system in Singapore, and there things seem to be quite good.
The things in Singapore are very impressive. What we did is we stepped back and said, who seems to be doing best in the world? And as Russ has pointed out, Singapore consistently comes in number one in the TIMSS research. And so we said it would be interesting to look at how Singapore compares to the United States in terms of its textbooks, its framework, its tests, and how it prepares teachers.
Before we get too far, Singapore is also known for a kind of an authoritarian style that has given it great economic prowess, but there's also complaints on the other side that it's not exactly the sort of the freest environment, one that would be familiar to us as Americans.
Well, I think that all of the international comparisons raise questions about comparability, and there are ways in which different countries are comparable and ways in which they aren't. Obviously, the size is a factor, that Singapore is so much smaller than the United States, and yet it still is about the same size as Los Angeles or Chicago. People worry about diversity. Singapore actually is about 75% Chinese, but there's a quarter of the population that are ethnic minorities. So there are similarities in those kinds of ways. In terms of the authoritarianness, it's our sense that that's changing over time and not quite as authoritarian as they once were. But certainly, it's an Asian society, and most Americans would look at it as more disciplined than what you find in the United States.
Specifically, what are they doing there that we're not doing here that could account for that?
We think that the single most important factor is that Singapore has a coherent system of mathematics education. That what they've done is they've looked at their framework, the sort of skeleton of the mathematics topics, the textbooks that help implement that framework, the tests that support that framework, and the way in which teachers are prepared to implement that framework and use those textbooks are all coherent. They are all aligned. Everyone is pulling in the same direction. And that probably is the single most important difference, that coherence that you find in Singapore. And then when you look at each and every one of the components, you see a quality differential when you compare them to what we have in the United States.
So that's what Russ was talking about earlier. Russ, you were talking about a national standard, and this is one of the ways, I guess, that you can pull things together, not only a test for accountability, but textbooks, perhaps, that reflect the teaching and the training that the teachers have gotten.
Exactly.
They're all working with the same textbooks. How is it, I mean, is it a question of simply adopting better textbooks? Could the United States do that? Or is it really a matter of teachers working from the same kinds of books? They know what they're going to see no matter where they go.
I think that's a really important question, because what we've learned is that it really is a system, and that when you tinker with a single piece of the system, you don't seem to get the kind of improvement. In fact, part of our study was to look at four places in the United States that have implemented just the Singapore textbook materials: Montgomery County, Maryland, Northern Middlesex, Massachusetts, Paterson, New Jersey, and Baltimore, Maryland. And the results are not all that impressive. Now, this was not a very fancy, well-designed research study, but when you look at the schools that have adopted the Singapore materials alone, the teachers ran into problems of the mismatch with the state tests. They ran into mismatch with their district curriculum. So it's important that we not just focus on any one element, whether it's the teachers or it's the textbook or it's the framework, and look at the way in which they all pull together.
We are taking your calls this hour. 1-800-989-TALK is the number to call if you want to join the conversation about American education. Judy's on the line from Fort Lauderdale. Hello, Judy.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I find the discussion fascinating. I taught in the suburbs of Boston, public schools, junior high, senior high. Right now I'm teaching and have taught English as a second language to Europeans, adults. And a couple of comments. I really think the point about the coherence within the curriculum is extremely important. However, I also would like a little more information on who takes these tests, which students, because my students have told me and my cousins in Great Britain that at the age of 11 or 12, they take tests and are basically, it's a weeding out process. And a lot of the students have their lives determined for them, pretty much so. They don't get second chances. At the age of 12 or 13, they go to trade schools, and those who do well go on in Germany, for example, to the schools they call the gymnasium, which is your academic, your college prep schools. And if these are the students, if these are only the students that are taking part in these tests, then it would seem to me the results are rather skewed, because, of course, our philosophy is not to weed out students at the age of 12.
Well, let's get a response. Russ Whitehurst?
Yes. The international assessments take into account students in all secondary settings, if we're talking about high school tests. So the test would include students who are in trade schools as well as students who are in gymnasium in Germany. So they are fair assessments. One could argue that perhaps they're tilted a bit in favor of the United States, and that we can't assess students who are not in school, and the dropout rate tends to be higher in the United States for high school than other countries, and so actually there's a smaller proportion of, for example, 15-year-olds who were eligible to take the test in the United States than would be the case in Germany.
Okay, Judy?
Yes. One more thing. In listening to my students, a large part of our teaching, of course, is conversation and trying to find things to talk about that everybody can talk about, and we often do talk about education. And at least from the German-speaking students, they don't seem to think that highly of their education. I've been told their classes are extremely rigid, that often the teachers don't care about the students, that everything is quite lackadaisical as far as attendance goes, and that often, for example, if a teacher is sick, the students go to that class, and there's no substitute, and they wait for the teacher. If he doesn't show up, they all go home. So I just have a different slant on it from talking to my students.
All right. Well, let's get it. We'll get a response for that, too. Thank you very much, Judy. Did you want to talk a little bit about, Steve, did you want to talk about the testing standards, and then we can get into whether or not you want to go to school there?
Well, I think that the issue of the testing is, in terms of Singapore, we really looked at K-6. And in Singapore, mm-hmm. there is a national uniform examination given to all students at the end of sixth grade. It's called the Primary School Leaving Examination. And rather than weeding out, I mean, at that early on stage, it basically is a sorting device. I mean, unlike what we have here, but it sorts people into what they call the special or express schools or the normal academic, normal technical schools. But the issue of comparability is almost every student in Singapore takes that test, and almost the entire age cohort is tested, just as we have in the United States.
I want to talk a little bit about the difference in education, something that Judy was getting at, the idea that you can get good results on test scores if you use a certain style in education. She talked about the rigidity. I'll share an experience with you and get a comment. I worked with students, and some were foreign students. They were international students, and others were Americans, and we were doing the same project. When I worked with the international students, man, they showed up on time, they focused, they could actually sit still, listen, and do what I asked, and then and come up with a great project. The Americans, on the other hand, were never on time, never focused. But when I said, well, we need to write a song here, the Americans just jumped at it and took it, and the international students said, well, we can't do that. The cadence is wrong. We've never learned to write that song. And they absolutely shrunk in the face of that challenge. So, I mean, now, obviously that's not a very good scientific test, but what about that? Is there some difference in the way we're going to approach problem solving, given two different styles of teaching?
Well, we didn't look at the actual classroom study, but Russ can talk extensively about the TIMSS video study that shows that there are really very different scripts around the world in how classroom instruction goes forth. I think in terms of our Singapore work, it's important to note that the title of our report is What the United States Can Learn from Singapore's World-Class Mathematics System and what Singapore can learn from the United States. In fact, we think that when you look at Singapore's texts and Singapore's frameworks, they're really missing the boat in terms of applications. You don't have the same richness of communication and connections and of the communication that your caller just spoke of and that we think are places where the United States really has a great deal to teach Singapore, for example.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Ravi is on the line from New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hello, Ravi.
Hi, Dad. How are you?
Good.
I was a teacher in India for about 15 years, and I've been teaching here for the past 25 years. My son was born in this country, and I have seen him grow to be an adult. And your speaker or your guest hit it right on the head when he said it's a mile wide and an inch deep.
Hmm.
Some of the observation, again, I'm sure some of the listeners may not agree with me. I think it basically comes down to five factors. One is the curriculum, the other is the teachers, and the third is the parents, and the mental block, which I seem to be getting from the quote-unquote local students from this country when I teach them the physics after they have graduated from the high school. And the fifth item, of course, is retention. When I was graduating from the high school in India back in the 60s, some of the students had to be held back in that grade. I don't see that trend here. And plus, back home, the culture was, used to be, I'm sure it's even now it's today, math is, we are told repeatedly, math and physics is important for your survival. It's like saying here, the kids, hey, you better pass the driving test, otherwise you cannot survive. So that put us into a different mode. And also, there's a mental block for reasons which I'm still surprised. When I visit my used to visit my kids' high school. The teachers used to ask me, what do you do? When I tell them I'm a physicist, they used to say, oh, my God, you're a physicist. So I don't know where this mental block comes in. So if the teachers have that mental block, how can they translate it? Plus, I don't think we are challenging our kids mentally enough. That's what I think.
For example,
to be very short, I'm sorry. I'm
oh, shoot. Go ahead.
Time.
Quickly.
In the first grade, we had to memorize table from 1 through 5. In the grade 2, I had to memorize 1 through 10 and 1 through 15 and what have you. Plus, the challenge was the teacher is asked to at random, like 15 times 15.
Mm-hmm. Right. So is it, all right.
It's missing here.
All right.
And when I take my kid to the JCPenney and he wanted to buy some electronics, like computers, 30% of 200, whereas the other store is 20% of 180. He could not solve it.
He can't make the change. Well, let's get the response. Thank you, Ravi. Yeah, Steve?
Well, I think that the issue of mile wide, inch deep is something we've talked about before. Russ mentioned it. Your caller mentioned it. We looked at that very specifically. In Singapore, there are about 15 topics per year. That's it. I mean, basically, you are able to spend somewhere around 2 weeks per topic. When you look at equivalent bite-sized topics, we find 20 in California, which is pretty impressive. California has tried to model their curriculum off of Singapore. There are 39 topics per grade level in Florida. There are 29 in Maryland. There are 26 in Ohio. That breeds a problem of overkill, of many too many topics. We also have the problem in the United States of textbooks having to respond to state frameworks. And many state frameworks ask for many different topics, and so we end up with 700-page textbooks filled with topics and this sense of we repeat and we reteach and we reteach. When Texas says do it in third grade and California says do it in fifth grade, textbooks need to put that topic into both grade levels. It doesn't send a consistent message about when it needs to be taught. And so when the caller speaks to this issue of mastery, we find in Singapore a much greater attention to, we are teaching it, we are teaching it fully, we are giving you 2 weeks to learn it, 2 weeks to teach it in third grade, and we expect it to be learned, and we're providing you all the resources to be able to do it.
Steve Linewine with the American Institutes for Research, thank you very much.
The caller also talked about attitudinal differences, cultural differences, and that's very important to very important as well. Students in this country, as well as teachers, tend to attribute success to ability. And in many of the countries that do better, the attribution is to hard work. If we work hard, we can learn it. In this country, well, if you're able to do math, you'll get it. And that affects fundamentally how people approach the task.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about education in America today with Russ Whitehurst, director for the Institute of Education Science. And joining us now is Mary Hatwood Futrell. She's the dean of the George Washington University Graduate School of Education and Human Development. She studied the educational system in the U.K. and joins us now to discuss the differences in schools here with schools there. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show, but I think I should make a correction. I don't want to come across as having studied. I have visited schools in the U.K. and France and different countries.
But we will trust your judgment. What did you find? What did you find?
I beg your pardon?
What did you find?
Well, I found a couple of things. When I visited the schools in the U.K., they had a common core curriculum that they required students to study. Another thing that really impressed me was that many of the schools had programs that they provided for parents to help parents learn how to work with their children as it related to their education, their homework, et cetera. And so I was very impressed with the fact that the schools provided free of charge programs during the day, during the evenings for parents to come in to learn, to improve their own education, but also to work more closely with their children. I was very impressed, for example, in France with the early childhood education programs that they have, where they start as early as 2 and 3 years old on a voluntary basis for children to go to school to become prepared for their formal education. And then when they get to, for example, 4th and 5th years, they are there on a full-time basis. I was very impressed in Singapore and in Japan and some of the other countries with the cohesion of the curriculum and how they had less redundancy in their curriculum than we tend to have in ours. I was also very impressed with the amount of time that they set aside during the day for the teachers to work together to address learning problems they have within the school. And so from from a number of countries, I learned a variety of things that I thought were very positive in improving the quality of education, and that I think that we could pay attention to here in America.
Very briefly, what is it? We heard also that this could be a two-way street. What is it that American schools may have to offer to some schools abroad, at least the ones you visited?
Well, one of the things that I hear people abroad speaking of quite frequently regarding American schools is how our children seem to be better prepared to integrate what they've learned into the larger society, whether that's work, the community, et cetera, and as opposed to being very narrowly defined as it relates to what they have learned and the ability to apply it. And they view many of our students, especially those we would consider to be generalists, to be better prepared to adapt to the changing society in which we live. However, again, the emphasis is on the quality of the education they receive and how they can apply what they have learned to the environment and to the situation in which they live.
We're going to talk about ways to bridge that gap as our conversation on education continues. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now on the program, we're talking about education in America and comparing it to education abroad. 1-800-989-TALK is the number to call if you want to join our conversation with Russ Whitehurst, Director for the Institute of Education Services, and Mary Hetwood Futrell, Dean of the George Washington University Graduate School of Education. And just before the break, Russ, we were talking about the give and take, what international schools could learn from the United States. How would you blend these two? We've talked about what's wrong in the United States. It seems that not having a coordinated curriculum, not having accountability standards, not having a national standard might be part of the problem, as well as discipline and some of those other what we might call intangibles. How do we bring those into our system without losing the few benefits that we think we have?
I think it's possible to incorporate some of the things we've learned from other countries into our system. We also need to retain this country's unique investment in every child succeeding. We don't have a tracking system where at the end of fifth grade we make a decision about whether a child will pursue a vocational career or higher education. We allow children and students to continue to grow, and I think we need to retain a commitment to that. Otherwise, we will not serve the needs of this nation.
Mary Futrell?
Well, I think that when we look at other countries, things that we can learn, for example, I would really like to see us have a universal early childhood education program in this country. At the same time, I would agree we have had to deal with issues related to diversity far more so than the countries with which we are compared. Have we always been successful? The answer is no. But I think that we have probably been more successful than the countries who are competing with us. And as their populations change, it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that changing diversity. But I think placing more emphasis on a coherent curriculum, making sure we have high standards that align with that curriculum, and making sure that everyone understands what they will be accountable and they will be held accountable will help improve education in this country and help us be more competitive.
Let's go to the phones. Mark is on the line from Lansing, Michigan. Hello, Mark.
The question that I had is, I guess I don't really understand why this is such a big issue, because it seems like in corporate America there are a lot of people that have excelled even though they're not necessarily academically gifted. And, even the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S., I mean, some of these people are, they didn't excel academically, but doing just fine.
The friends in high places argument? It's not what you know, but do you know? No, but you make a larger point. And the question is, as I understand it, what about the value of these tests and test scores? And do they tell us everything we need to know about what it takes to be a solid citizen and, and a mature adult? Dean Futrell?
Well, I don't think the tests by themselves will give us the answer, but the tests will certainly give us guidance as it relates to where are areas that we need to strengthen programs, where are the children who need additional help. But going back to his larger question about the emphasis on education, I think that what we're seeing is a changing society, and not just within the United States, but globally. And that society is demanding that more people be educated and that they be educated better than they've ever been educated before. And how are we going to use education to help us deal with the cultural changes, the technological changes, the economic changes that we're facing, and how are we going to make sure people have the skills and the knowledge and the experiences that they will need in order to succeed? And when we look at our country, we have been very successful. And I think, again, it goes back to the comment that was made earlier. One of the reasons we've been successful is because we have tried to educate all the people in this country. Have we been as successful as we would like to be? quality. We have some work to do, but we've been a lot more successful than a lot of countries.
Russ Whitehurst?
Well, there are always instances where absent good education or absent learning math or science, there are opportunities and people do well. But the facts are that preparation in these areas is an important predictor, for example, of students' readiness for college and their successful pursuit of a college degree. And we know that in an increasingly internationally competitive circumstance, we're not going to be able to continue to succeed as a nation if we have circumstances where only 1% of the declared majors at the college level are in mathematics, and that's 30 to 35% in India. So there are issues here that I think are important from a national perspective. There will always be room for individuals who have motivation, who are entrepreneurial, who work hard to succeed, but they'll succeed at higher rates if they have the kind of academic preparation that I believe is important.
Russ Whitehurst, Director for the Institute of Education Science at the Institute of Education Science, thank you very much. And Mary Hatwood Futrell, Dean of the George Washington University Graduate School of Education and Human Development, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a look at No Child Left Behind. Should it be extended into high school? Stay with us.